I would like to continue a little bit to look at this question of identity and looking at again different elements. But I want to finish a little bit with a feeling tone and noticing how feeling tone also can be somewhat, especially nowadays, connected to identity. I don't know, but I presume some of you are on Facebook, are on Twitter, are on Instagram. I mean, that's the one I use myself, but I'm sure there are more than that. And basically, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, but especially Instagram and Facebook, are all about likes. And this is basically about feeling tone. So you put a picture on Instagram, you get 5 likes, 10 likes, and basically the person is saying, oh, I look at your photo and it gives me a pleasant feeling tone. Or if you put something on YouTube, but then here you have two possibilities. Either you have the thumb up or you have the thumb down. So, you know, some people say, I see this, good feeling tone. I see this, bad feeling tone. And then according to your likes or dislikes, your identity is going to go up and down. You know, if you have what is also interesting is how from being, you could nearly say nobody, by the amount of likes you have on YouTube, you can become somebody. My favorite one is Gangnam Style. I love Gangnam Style. I mean, of course, because he's Korean, but I love it because here, in a way, you have somebody who normally would be nobody. But in Korea, he's somebody, but outside of Korea, he really was not somebody. And then suddenly, because of all the likes he gets on YouTube, he dances with Madonna. I mean, I loved it. I thought, this is great. This is a revolution in terms of identity, you know. Anybody can be somebody. So this is very interesting to look at because like a few years ago I was doing an evening on actually mindfulness and the usage of the internet. It was quite fun. And before that, I was interviewed by a young woman for a little article. And then the first question she asked me is, how many likes do you have on Facebook? And I thought, likes? Facebook? You know, I mean, I have individual likes for my photo, which are not that many. But she said, no, you know, likes, you know. So we look in the internet, and then we can finally, I realized she's talking about my fan page, which is fairly inactive. So I don't know, I had like some 650 likes or something like that. And then she goes and look at hers, and she has 850 and say, look, you know, I am more than you. And I thought, great, you know, little boost to her identity. So to me, all these things are wonderful in terms of identity, you know. Does my identity go up and down according to how many likes I get or not? I personally, I play with it on Instagram because there is some photo I like to take photos. And so some photo I put because I like them myself. So they give me good feeling tones. But I know they might not necessarily give good feeling tone to others. But then I might put photo and I'm fairly sure it will be give good feeling tone to others. And generally I'm kind of relatively right there. I can, you know, one get 5 likes and then the other one get 25 likes. So it's interesting, kind of playing like that with, in a way, is your identity resting on how many likes you have. That I think is an interesting one. But then, in a way, we can also look at possession. how much possession we need, how much possession we want, things. I always love, like when you have the latest iPhone, then you have the people who queue all night to get the latest iPhone. And then I'm like, you know, I mean, possibly they might need the latest iPhone, I don't know. But what does it do to your identity that, in a way, you have the latest gadget? My brother-in-law generally has the latest gadget, and we generally are in the prehistory. So he kind of, you know, shows us his latest iPhone or iPad, and we kind of like... And to me, it's something that I use. It's really something that I use. It's really not something where my identity is kind of connected to. But I wonder sometime if having those things is kind of like adding a little something to the identity. And then you have kind of like a little competition. You know, my iPhone is better than yours. My identity is better than yours. And there was this very interesting story I read in the paper. And it was about this young man who came from a relatively poor family, but through studying hard, finally got some MBA, something to do with finance. And then in New York, he worked with making money on the stock market. And generally, if you do that, you get bonus. And so he's somebody who never had much money, but after his first year working there, he got a bonus for $15,000. And he'd never had $15,000 before. So when he got this $15,000, he thought, wow, this is amazing. He felt incredibly good. It really, in a way, boosted his sense of identity. But then he asked other people, how much did they get? And the others got 50,000, 100,000, then immediately his 15,000 was like, not much. So immediately his kind of identity went a little down. And then he realized the next 3 years, what everybody was doing, their identity rested on having the biggest bonus. And that's what they were all competing for, so that they would feel better if they had the bigger one. And so he realized, after 3 years of that, he realized however much money he had, there was always somebody who had more, which then made him feel bad about what he had. And then he decided to stop, because he could realize that this really was a strange way to live, to actually rest your identity on the fact that you had a bigger bonus than somebody else. He thought it was a little kind of unsubstantial in one way to base one identity on that. So he kind of decided to do something else. But it's interesting in terms of possession, in terms of things. How do we identify with things? Because in a way we have certain needs. But when we have satisfied these needs, because they do lots of study of that, about happiness and wealth and things. And one of the studies they did was, once you got, I don't know, like $80,000, then your happiness does not increase. I mean, it's quite a lot already, but we won't go there. But what is interesting is kind of to look that sometimes you have this feeling you need more and more, so that you kind of like feel your identity is bigger. The more you have money, the more you have things, then really your identity is bigger. And that's why we see this, I always love this, when you have this latest billionaire and having his yacht, his big boat, bigger than the other one. So it's kind of like, it's weird, like, you know, part of the identity is in the bigness of the boat. Strange where you put one might put one's identity. And then it's a question, not that we cannot enjoy things, But are we, in a way, creatively engaging, using resources in an appropriate way? So that then we have kind of a fluid sense of identity in terms of possession. Or do we need to have more and more so that we kind of have this feeling that, oh yeah, I have all these things, so then my, it's kind of like there are more foundation in a way for my identity. Does my foundation rest in goods? There is this teacher, I mean, who is dead now, Achan Chan. And what is very weird in Thailand, he was a Thai teacher, is that people give lots of expensive things to renunciate monks. It's kind of a strange thing. They give them big watches, and you go into their room and they have all these weird things on the wall that people have given them, which are expensive. And in his case, he had this beautiful glass. He was given by somebody. And then you have this young man who come along and said to him, but you are a renunciate, you know, you should not have this beautiful glass. You're going to be attached to it. And he said to the young man, I can enjoy the beautiful glass, I can use it, but for me, it is already broken. So, in a way, he did not identify with it, he did not grasp at it, because he knew it was impermanent. But that does not stop him from enjoying it, in the same way that we can enjoy the tulip while they are lasting like that. And so this is, in a way, to see what kind of relationship do I have with possession, with money, with things, in terms of my identity. Because, like all things, you know, possession is impermanent. So are we putting a lot of weight in terms of our identity on something which is relatively impermanent? This is something kind of, to me, which is interesting into, if we have a fluid sense of identity, which is resting on many different things, then you might have one which kind of goes poof, but you'll have other who are still there. But if you put everything in one place, and that things go, then where is your identity going to be based upon? Another thing which is interesting to look at is culture. Often one has the impression that when one talks about the spiritual path, meditation, and often you hear this word, unconditioned. And so sometimes it gives the impression that if you practice long enough, you will be unconditioned by anything. So you will go to a place which is above everything. But actually what it meant, the term, the way it used in the early literature, the Buddha said, awakening is about being unconditioned by greed, hatred, and confusion. So it's not just unconditioned by itself, but it just means that we are not taken over by greed, hatred, and confusion. So we have to be careful to think that meditation, at some point, magically, is going to make us go above conditions. As I said before, on the contrary, I think meditation helps us to realize all the different conditions that influence us and in a way form our identity, meeting, of course, the outside conditions. And so one here which is interesting is culture. Because when we are within one culture, we don't think too much about our cultural identity. Unless somebody like me comes and suddenly I see this interesting object. I don't know how you call it, but this kind of things made of rye with the rice porridge in it, which from what I understand is a Finnish delicacy. And personally, I think this is a really interesting object. You know, who thought to do this? I think this is amazing that somebody in past history thought, right, yes, porridge, yeah, let's put it together. I think this is an interesting concept. So then here you see the culture, because it's very likely most Finnish people think, wow, this is delicious, such a treat. And then you have a French person who has never seen it, thinking, interesting, what is this? And so when you are within the culture, you really don't see how identified we are with the culture. And personally, I would say that actually the culture is like it's like a physical identity. Because often we think culture is just kind of like a zeitgeist, it's just like kind of something outside. But personally, I think actually culture is something which is embedded in the whole body and mind. And I think that meditation is not going, the aim of meditation is not going to take that cultural identity. It might loosen it, it might loosen it when we become aware of it, but you won't be making it you acultural. And this is what I realized when I lived for 10 years in Korea, in a Korean environment, in the way the people lived. And I was really struck twice. That once I was trying to wring, because there you don't have a washing machine, in those days you did not. So, you know, I had washed clothes by hand, and so I was kind of trying to wring them the best way I knew to, which was to do this. And then a Korean person saw me doing this and said, what's that? That's not the way to wring clothes properly. The way to wring clothes properly, you do this. So I had to kind of talk like that and do something like that. And what I was fascinated by is that I could not do it. Because for, you know, 20, 30 years, that's what culturally I had been adapted. And I was being told to do it like a different way. It was like, and of course it was the best way. But the best one was when I was kind of, again, I was trying to wash clothes like this, which is generally the way you would do it in France in the old days. And this tiny girl, 5 years old, who kind of come on, you really don't know how to do this properly. And then she takes the thing and she kind of does things with it. And I was like... And that's when I realized culture is really embedded. It's something that becomes us. That actually culture is part of our identity. And if we are in a place where everybody does the same, then we don't see it. And to me, that's what was so interesting, to see that what I used to do until I went to Korea, I thought this was the right way to do things. And then once I went to Korea, I realized this is the French way to do things. And then you have a Korean way to do things. But also, I could see that in a way you also have Buddhist culture. You have Buddhist acculturation. And so from coming from like a modern perspective, you can see the different culture. But being within the tradition, it's very hard to see that each Buddhist tradition is very acculturated in a certain form. And I remember for a while I was helping a little Korean group in London many years ago. I said, for Buddha's birthday, they did not have their center, let's go to a Buddhist center, a Thai Buddhist center. So we go to the Thai Buddhist center, very kindly, they let us do our thing. And then we go, and I said, how was that? And they said, well, the Buddha did not look right. Because it did not look like a Korean Buddha. It's true, he looked very different from a Korean Buddha. And to me that was very interesting to see that in a way one can identify with like Finnish culture or French culture, or one can identify with a Korean Buddhism or Thai Buddhism or whatever culture. And then in terms of identity, what we have to be careful with is to think, this is the way it is. This is the right way. And so in a way, kind of like assuming that our identity in a way is a norm, when actually it's a conditional identity upon these cultural forms. And that's why personally I'm very grateful. I lived for 10 years in Korea and I lived 16 years in England. And it was, I love this kind of like cultural way to see, oh yeah, there is a certain way to do this here, there is a certain way to do this here. And through adapting to other culture, then seeing my identity in a way shift a little. So when I am in Korea, I see, that's what is interesting, I see my French identity. When I'm in England, I see my French identity. But then when I'm in France, I see that actually I have a little bit of Korean identity, a little bit of English identity. So I'm not totally 100% French identity. And I find that interesting to see how culture forms our identity. And so, is it a fixed identity? Or is it a loose identity? Then there is another thing which can be very important in terms of identity. It's our role. And so here we move a little bit in terms of ourselves, but also ourselves within the society. And so often we can identify with our role. And I think what the meditation can help us to see that actually we can, instead of being fixed in certain role and possibly putting too much identity in certain role, we can actually be more like flowing, dancing through different identity. For myself, when I'm teaching here, I am a teacher. That's one role. But when I am with my mother, I am a doctor. When I am in a shop, I am somebody buying something. And so my identity is going to change all the time. But if you think one role gives you more identity, you might in a way be more embedded in that. And then the other one will be more in the background. But it might not be so helpful all the time to do that. Once, many years ago, I had a foreign teacher come and stay in my house. And this teacher was very big on awareness, but like really big. But the slight problem with that teacher is that she was always teaching. You know, she stayed a few days, but she was teaching breakfast, lunch, dinner. Be aware. Be aware. And when she left, I thought, oh, great, you know. Don't have to be aware all the time. And it was hard to relate because she was like always in the teaching mode. It's like if somebody is always in the mothering mode, always in this mode, always in that mode. And it can be a little kind of restricting, but also I think it can be a little difficult for people around. When to me the fun is actually to flow through the different roles. I think that's what the fun is. That one moment you can be, you know, oh yeah, you know, I am this teacher, and next moment, I mean, I had a wonderful experience recently. I could not do things. I had to take care of my mother, I had to do this, I had to do that, so I was at home for a few weeks, and I did not manage to do any shopping, and I really needed to do shopping, so finally I go to town. And I get there and I get in this weird mood, like kind of totally. And I go to the Apple shop and then I go to the next shop. And I thought, coming out of the Apple shop, I thought, if they knew I was a Zen teacher, they would be really surprised. And then, you know, afterward, I kind of calmed down, and then, oh, another day, I had this, and that was great. I was in some countries, and I hurt my finger, I cut my fingers, it was bleeding, I had to teach, so I went to teach with little straps, but I had to have some stitches. I had to have some stitches, and I have not had stitches like in 50 years. So I thought, when I was taken to the doctor to have stitches, I thought it was going to be modern. You know, like there were going to be some magical stitching, and you know, wonderful. And then I go to the thing, and the guy has this big needle. And he has this thread, thick thread. And he's going to put them in my fingers. And I'm sitting there, and my first thought is, I don't think I'm going to be able to be Zen. If you just do it like kind of like that, I'm not sure I can keep my Zenitude. And then the guy kind of gave me a shot of kind of anesthetic, and I thought, great, I can be Zen no matter what. But what I found interesting was that kind of identity, you know, kind of, you know, oh, I must be like this. It's kind of like you have the identity, then you have the representation of the identity to others. How you, because often with the role, it's about the role itself, the action, the activity of it, but it can also be about the appearance. You know, I am a Zen teacher, I must be like this. I am the perfect mother, I must be like that, or whatever it can be. And so it's kind of interesting to look at the thing itself and also its representation to ourselves, but also to others. Then another thing where a lot of our identity can rest upon is actually work. And this, I think, has a lot to do with ourselves, but I think it also has a lot to do with society. Because I think this is something to look at also, is in terms of society, is how society is going to identify certain work as better than others, as more worthy than others. And so if we have more worthy work, if you're a computer programmer, if you have a surgeon, if you are people like that, then this is really looked up. And then you kind of have the impression, oh, if I am a surgeon, if I am a computer programmer, then I am somebody. I have, and then a strong part of your identity will be in your work. And then you might do work which is not valued in that way. And then how can you yourself make your own identity valuable within that work? I think this is really something to look at in terms of work and how there is value and how it's connected to identity. I know for myself, so I was a nun for 10 years, which is, as I said before, it was kind of quite a relatively high status, one could say, and special status. Then I stopped being a nun, and then, since I have not been to university or I have nothing like that, then when I came back to England, I had to find some work. And then I was, it was suggested that I could become a house cleaner. So when the first time somebody said to me, you could have this house cleaning job, my little identity went like, pooh, I used to be a nun. You know? It was very interesting just to feel the kind of little, oops, kind of things going down. And then I thought, well, you know, it's true, I can do it, it's convenient. Why not? So I decided to become a house cleaner. which I did for 10 years. And to me, it was fascinating how I could then bring the meditation work to that activity. And again, find great value in it, do it the best I could, learned a lot from it. And from that, actually getting quite a great respect for house cleaner in general. And kind of, in a way, feeling sad that in some way it can be very lowly paid and very undervalued. But then to look a little bit at that, you have the work you do, and you could do a work which you value, which is helpful, which gives you good finances or enough finances. But then there is the way you look at it in the doing of it. There is also the way the society might look at it. And there is also the way you might look at how the society look at it. So actually you have often these three things that come together. And that's why I think it's kind of important for us to see, in terms of work, what is my relationship? In terms of how do I base my identity in the certain value of the work? Then there is also the activity itself. Because work, I think, to have some activity is important. We cannot not do, I mean, we could do nothing and just meditate, for example, if we wanted. But generally we lacked to act. I think, in a way, what with the meditation we're trying to do is have a balance between, I would say, two parts of our identity. The identity of doing something, of being active, and in a way the activity of not doing. And this is why sometimes meditating is challenging. Just sitting still is challenging. Because if you have a lot of your identity is in doing something, in being active, in having using a lot of your energy, then you sit. And you don't feel anything. It's kind of like, where is the identity? Kind of, where is it gone? I don't feel it. And so in a way this is a little bit of the challenge of the meditation, to see that, oh, even if I don't do anything, actually there is value within it. There is a way to be grounded, there is a way to be stable. But it's another way I experience myself. And I think that's what is kind of interesting in terms of identity, to see, how do I feel myself? Because when we talk of identity, it seems to be a little abstract. Identity, then you can think about all the things that makes it. But also we could look at, how does it feel? How does it change? How does it change within different contexts? Is it something I feel in my body? Is it something I feel in my heart, in my mind? Is it a combination of the three? And does it change this feeling of myself in the world? Then another thing we can look at in terms of identity is really where it's going to go in terms of so many different things. And then you again are going to have the thing itself. So for example, one might be a male, one might be a Finnish male, one might be a French female. Then one might be heterosexual, one might be gay, one might be transgender. I mean, nowadays kind of the identity are shifting, the pronoun shifting too, from she to he to they. And in a way, at any given moment, we have this different component of being French, of being female, of being old, of being small, of being married, of not being married, of studying, of not studying, of working, not working. I mean, there is all these different things. And so in a way we're trying to navigate all these different things. But sometimes it's kind of like, oh, what is going to... So sometimes all is kind of like, you know, in a balance. And then sometimes one might be more apparent. Suddenly that I'm a female might be more apparent. Or suddenly that I'm French might be more apparent. Or suddenly that I'm a teacher might be more apparent. And then how do we creatively engage with that? Because in a way there is a fact that we have this component. Then there is also the idea we have of what it means to be a female, to be French, to be heterosexual, to be gay, to be whatever. And also how it fits within the society also. So you have all these different, kind of like you have the identity itself, the component, and then all the different view about it, which are going to influence different things. I remember once, many, many, many years ago, I was a very young teacher. I go to America, and there is Jack Kornfield. He's a great meditation teacher, very well known. And so he had this, you know, big evening, 400 people, and Stephen, my husband, and myself were there going to give a workshop. And he said, oh, why don't you talk about a workshop? So to kind of, you know, have a few more people coming. So, because everybody is kind of like, you know, politically correct, then they ask me to speak first, you know, woman first. So here, I am asked to speak, to say a few words, and then I freeze. I cannot say anything. I'm like... So then my Stephen comes and speaks instead of me. And then afterward, I reflected upon it. What happened? What happened? Why did you freeze? It was like... And I froze because I suddenly identified with the thought, I have never spoken to 400 people. And that's what made me not being able to do it. How can I generally have spoken to 5, 10, 20 people, how can I speak to 400 people? And I could not do it. But then I thought, phew, this is really not good. Because I'm a bit of a feminist, and I thought, as a feminist, this is not good. You did not show up. For the feminist, you must do it. So after that, I decided no matter what, I'll show up. And it totally changed it. After that, somebody asked me, oh, do you want to speak at this big conference, 2,000 people? I said, sure, why not? You know? And to me, what in a way made the difference is that suddenly there was in a way that kind of energy to identify. But I would say to identify in a positive way. And so to say, oh yeah, I must stand up for that. I must kind of show the courage, the energy of that. And so to see that identity actually can be something, of course, which can fix us. But I think also identity can be something in which we can ground ourselves and in a way use the energy of that. The energy of being male, female, of being French, Finnish, of being a teacher, of being whatever, being an artist. That actually, if we creatively engage with that identity, we actually can get quite a lot of energy from that. But at the same time, not fixing on it. Because then we think, oh, I felt so great doing that, and then now I'm going to do it forever. But again, back to the dance. And then,
in terms of identity, I think what it's also something to look at, to explore, is what I would call the society, the societal norm, the cultural norms. That is kind of nearly like kind of there is a certain identity, like the kind of cultural identity, like we should be like this, or if you are so and so, you should be like that, or if I am like this, I should be like that. And so then there is always a question that sometimes we can fit the norm, let it be the Buddhist norm. You know, generally the Buddhist norm is that you are really calm, you don't get angry. But if you are a fiery person, how do you fit the norm? You have many different norms. Some culture you have to be quiet, some culture you have to be lively, etc. Some culture you have to be ultra polite. Some culture you have to be direct. So there is kind of this kind of relative norm identity within the culture. And sometimes you can suit that norm, but sometimes not. And I think this is something also we have to navigate, the kind of the norm of the society. How can I creatively engage with the fact that I don't fit it? Because we might not always be able to fit it. And then what I wanted to say in the end was to look in terms of identity and anatta about confidence. That actually, when we look at anatta, and there is this term of not self, then again this idea of emptiness. But personally, I have found the opposite, I could nearly say, that in a way the more I meditate, the more I discover the condition that forms me with awareness, with clear awareness. Then actually I realize I become more and more confident. Not arrogant, but confident. And so in a way, at one level, you have this idea of not self, but really experiencing the not self will actually make for a more healthy, more confident, more wise, more compassionate self. And why is that? And I feel this is because with the mindfulness, with the awareness, it really helps us to see clearly. And that's why I call it creative awareness. It helps us to see very clearly all the components that forms us. So we don't just look at one, but we discover all of it. And then what we can see is that actually we have got a lot of good qualities. And what is interesting is that if we see these good qualities, then actually if we see them clearly and we appreciate them, then we're going to be able to develop them more. It's nearly like naturally, if we see them clearly, then we manifest them, then they develop more. But of course at the same time, we have difficult conditions. We have difficult qualities. But the clarity will help us to see them very clearly. And then it will help us not to be stuck in them. Not to, I would say, negatively identify with them. But on the contrary, understand that actually I am not always like this. So when does it happen? So that in a way we can creatively engage with different aspects of ourselves, and the difficult one too. And I know for myself, I have this little fiery, little kind of agitation, and I can be angry. And in the past, I could be angry for a day or two. And now, it comes, I sit, and it goes very fast. So it's not that the thing will go necessarily, but often what happens is that it really diminishes in terms of intensity, in terms of time. And so I think in a way the meditation helps us to really in a way creatively engage with all the components of our identity. has any questions or comments. Yes.
I don't know if this is going to turn out to be a question or more a comment, but let's see. I've been thinking a little bit about the guilt and shame we talked yesterday more, and somehow for me it seems that sometimes we can get attached more to the idea of the emotion than the emotion itself. Because if you imagine a hypothetical human being that never encountered a society, could you experience a guilt? Because let's say I steal an apple, but I have never been in a society, well, I might, I don't know, would I ever feel guilty, actually? Though I can experience fear on my own, anger, and I can attach to those, because they're somehow more existing, but it feels to me that guilt and shame, they're coming as the, like, as an idea of the emotion, and we don't really even have that emotion as a core emotion. And it's formed by the society, and without society it doesn't exist. That's how it feels to me.
Partly. I think, you see, you have different type of guilt and a different type of shame. But there is no doubt that in terms of the norms, what is normative, then there is, in a way, there is certain things which the society will see as good things, and there is certain things they will see as bad things. And once I had this interesting experience of a friend who was from Holland, and she was saying to me, "I feel guilty." And I said, "What about?" And she said, "I feel guilty that I'm not working, so I'm not earning money to pay taxes, so I can contribute to society." And she said this to a French person. And the sports in French is not to pay taxes if you can help it. And I was like, "What? You feel guilty about that?" And so to me it was very interesting type of guilt which I had never encountered before. And so, of course, the society will bring certain norms which will be attached to the identity. If I'm such and such person and I do such and such things, then I feel good about myself. If I don't do that, then I feel guilty in connection to that. So then it's really kind of, at one level it is true. There is kind of a guilt which is more like an abstract guilt, which is created by the society in terms of norms that everybody decide on. But I think there is also, what I was mentioning before, it's also just the unpleasant feeling tone we experience if we make a mistake. The unpleasant feeling tone if we said something to somebody which was not appropriate. And then in a way you will feel bad because you did this. And then of course you can call it guilt. But in a way you could call it, "I feel an unpleasant feeling tone because I made a mistake. I feel an unpleasant feeling tone because I hurt someone." And so then, is it guilt, is it regret? Because the two can be a little connected. So I think, in a way, you can have the societal one, which I think often can be more abstract and can change. Because, I mean, before, if you were a single mother, I mean, this was really bad. Nowadays, who cares? So it's kind of very interesting when that type of guilt actually change very much what it is about, change according with the different norm of the society. When I think the unpleasant feeling tone, when you make a mistake, when you hurt somebody, that I think is different. Okay, so we might stop here.